My guest today is James Bender. James, how you doing, bud?
How you doing?
Welcome back to the show. It's been a long time.
It has been. Good to see you again. Of course, I see you a lot, but it's good to see you on the web.
It's good to see you again. What are you doing these days?
Well, I've been writing a lot of code, managing a lot of projects, working kind of on that stuff. Obviously, still big into kind of the architectural concepts, still WCF.
Yep, you're the WCF guy.
Still, obviously, my
love affair. We've spoken about that on the show.
We have. Love affair with that continues. Gotten married since the last time I've been on the show, so that's something different.
I know, it's a Gail. She's way better looking than you, by the way.
It's true. It's not a high bar, though. F-Sharp is still floating around kind of in the ether, but really the thing I've kind of been pushing more as we've gotten into more projects and more working with different clients and various developers. Some of our developers aren't necessarily experienced, and some of them are not located near us, is finding better ways to kind of advance the test-driven development concepts. I wrote that book about TDD about a year and a half ago.
I read that book. It was really good.
Oh, thank you. And I still really believe in everything that book says, but we've kind of now that we've been bringing more business analysts into the team, and we've kind of been working more with clients who aren't necessarily on site all the time, we're starting to kind of delve into the idea of BDD, business-driven development, sometimes referred to as behavior-driven development.
Okay.
Or another thing that's become very popular right now is this idea of ATDD, which is acceptance test-driven development.
Are they the same thing?
They are not really. I mean, essentially what it comes down to, and I'll caveat, this is my little disclaimer, there's all kinds of opinions around this stuff.
Okay.
Everybody's got their little dogma, and I guarantee no matter what you do, someone out there is going to say you're doing it wrong.
Sure. Let's take a time out. Let's define BDD.
Right.
We can't even decide what it actually stands for yet.
Well, and I've heard it both ways, and I've heard there's a distinction, and some people say there is.
What's your definition of BDD?
So my definition of BDD is basically, well, contrasting with TDD, just to kind of clear.
TDD is test-driven development.
Test-driven, but really it's a question of focus. When I hear TDD, what I think of is, I'm developing a class library, or I'm working on a controller or a model, and I'm really defining and testing my API for that.
Okay, and we call that a unit test, because it's just doing a real small piece of code.
Right, a unit of work. And even kind of more, kind of, again, tying into the focuses, it's usually a developer, they're usually thinking API, they're not usually necessarily thinking big picture or how it fits into the business, just thinking, I need to write this library that does XYZ.
Okay.
And that's kind of how they approach it,
yep.
Which is fine. And there's still a lot of value there. Business-driven development or behavior-driven development, however you want to call it, is a little more almost higher-level view. It's thinking, not just I have this API, I have this business task.
Okay.
And how do I approach this business task? Now, you still want to keep your tests atomic, and you still want to keep them focused.
All right. Atomic in this context means?
Meaning I only want to test one thing at a time. If I have a layer of application that crosses various strata, I only want to test necessarily one strata at a time.
Okay.
Now, I can do that with test-driven development, but what I might do is I might start writing my integration tests in a BDD style, or I found I could even write my unit tests in a BDD style.
Okay.
So I'm really kind of talking about two things. I'm talking about the integration tests, which are more kind of the cross-cutting tests.
They're less atomic.
Less atomic. They go through all the layers from the UI down to the database and back.
Okay.
Those are very important as well. A lot of people kind of skip those, but you need to really have those. They ensure all your pieces and parts are talking to each other and speaking the same language, especially with things like JavaScript and dynamic languages now. Very important, because you don't have the compiler or things to back you up.
Sure.
Whereas unit tests, I still see value in those for the API, and I also have developers who now, if their unit tests or their APIs are getting a little more complicated, or they have to kind of interact with other different things, or there might be a little more complicated setup or evaluation, what they're also doing is writing our unit tests, our API tests, in this business-driven development for a couple of reasons. For one thing, it's easier for the developer sometimes to conceptualize those steps, and by using a language called Gherkin, which is derived from the Cucumber tool, which is a domain-specific language based around testing.
Let's just back that up a second. Okay. Cucumber is a domain-specific language.
Gherkin is a domain-specific language.
Gherkin is a domain-specific language.
Right.
Cucumber is what?
Cucumber is a business-driven development framework, which is usually used by Ruby folks.
Okay. All right.
But it's still the analog on the .NET side would be something called SpecFlow.
Specflow is a .NET specific.
.NET specific.
BDD tool.
Yeah, or ATDD. And kind of maybe we should talk about that tool now. The way the tool works, because this might also kind of help crystallize this.
I still have a good definition of what business-driven development is.
We've kind of talked about it
for the last couple minutes.
It's really about defining the business behaviors and how I want this to work in a business context.
Got it. Okay.
And writing my tests based on that.
So that's what you're bringing up, a test-driven development as a distinction.
Right.
Between focusing on just the inputs and the outputs of a module or a method or a class or whatever versus the business functionality.
Right.
I need to be able to process my end-of-month accounts payable.
Sure.
That sort of thing.
Right. And it's great for things like that. It's great for integration tests where I can have, with using this Gherkin language, which we can talk about in a minute, I can actually have my business analysts write, essentially they can write my tests for me.
Okay. Define domain-specific language real quick.
So domain-specific language is basically a language that, it's a smaller language designed for a specific problem set.
Okay.
The example I like to use is, if you ever go to Starbucks, and you go in there and you say, I want a tall, triple grande, no foam.
Yeah.
They know what you mean. Right. That is a domain-specific language. It's a language to describe how to prepare a cup of coffee.
Got it.
That's and the IT world, the development world, is becoming very full of these domain-specific languages to deal with various different problems.
All right, let me create these so that we can talk, so that the users and the developers can have a common language they both understand.
Right.
Not having to learn C#, or God forbid, developers have to learn English.
Well, yeah, that's another issue, too. So the language we use for, again, BDD is called something called Gherkin.
Okay. That is a DSL.
That is a DSL. It's the domain being testing.
Got it. Okay.
And what that does is it's something that's very easy. Business analysts can use it.
Uh-huh.
It survives what I call the parent test, where I could put it in front of my parents and they could read it and figure out what it's trying to do.
Okay. Give me an example of just some.
So an example is the kind of syntactic model it uses is this idea of given, when, then.
All right.
Given a set of conditions,
mm-hmm.
when I do something,
all right.
then I should have a result of some type. Say,
okay. All right.
So given I have a the example I use in my talks is the game tic-tac-toe.
Huh?
So one of the example of a test might be, given I have an empty game board, when I try to find the winner of the game, then the result should be that no one's won.
Okay.
Or given I have all X's in the top row, when I try to determine the winner, then the winner should be X.
Okay.
And it's literally written out that way.
Yep.
And Gherkin's got very few keywords, but it looks for that given, when, then. And if you need to do some compounding statements, you can do given, blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah.
Yep.
And it'll join them together.
How about in the when as well? You could have when.
When, this, and occur. This. Although I try to avoid that because when I do my when, and what happens is, to kind of jump ahead a little bit, this will explain why I don't like doing this. Each line of that Gherkin gets translated into a separate end unit or MS test unit test.
Okay.
And my concern with the when is, the when essentially maps to executing an action, like hitting a button or calling a procedure.
Okay.
And I don't really like to use ands there because it presumes that a couple of different things are going to happen at once or in sequence.
Right.
And so I really try to, and I'm not saying you can do it all the time, but as a general practice, I have found it's easier if you try to avoid having the ands and the when.
Okay.
Just makes it, I think, a little all cleaner, right. A little easier.
Probably true is the then also. Generally speaking, you
right.
want to assert a single thing at a time.
A single thing at a time. Although when you get into things like integration tests,
mm-hmm.
it's more okay to have those common asserts, or I'm sorry, those compound asserts at the end. For instance, if I'm creating a new order.
Okay.
And I submit the order then. I want to make sure all the fields in the order are correct.
Yeah.
I want to make sure that the price is being calculated.
You could, theoretically, you could do that twice, but sometimes these things take a long time. And
oh, absolutely. And you want to conserve that. Now, if I'm doing unit tests, and I do occasionally write Gherkin for my unit tests, depending upon how complex my setup or my evaluation is, I will try to limit the ands. Because, again, when you're talking about unit tests, you should have one specific thing happening and one specific result that you're looking at.
Okay.
So it kind of depends on which side of that testing line you're on, if you're on the unit testing or the integration.
Actually, are you having your users write tests using Gherkin,
or
are you having your developers write those tests?
Well, for the integration, kind of the big business tests is what I've been calling them, we've been having our BAs write those with input from the product owners, which are usually the clients.
And that's okay. The BAs are technical enough that they can
Well, the beauty is the BAs don't have to be technical to write the Gherkin.
Okay.
Once you teach them the syntax, it's fairly simple.
Okay.
The big struggle we've had is using SpecFlow. It's all in Visual Studio, and you create this thing called a feature file, which is essentially where your Gherkin lives.
Okay.
And that's in a Visual Studio project. There are various paid tools you can get to put that Gherkin in there. I haven't been able to justify the expense of buying one. I don't really know of a low cost one. So if anybody on TV land knows one, please let me know. But so it's kind of been, how do we get the Gherkin from the BA to the developer? And we've tried a couple different things. We really don't want to necessarily install Visual Studio on the BA's machines.
They don't have it already. It's just for that one purpose and overkill.
Right. And additionally, we use Git for our version control. And that can be a little... We're talking about having put Git for Windows on the machines to make it a little bit easier. But Git is a little esoteric maybe for some BAs to understand.
Okay.
There are some developers
who struggle with it. The whole point of this is to make it easier, to remove that friction.
Sure, remove that
from
friction.
From the people that are less technical to be able to write those tests.
Right. And it's been working very well. The Gherkin that gets created really defines what the business role needs to be. And then what happens is, what SpecFlow does is, it takes each line of Gherkin, and essentially it creates a end unit test. Hmm. And really what SpecFlow is really just a code generator.
Okay.
And what happens is it actually creates a little, what I call an end unit engine. And I'm saying end unit, you can use it with MS Test too.
Okay, some unit testing framework.
Yeah. But what happens is it essentially runs those tests in the order they appear in the Gherkin.
Okay.
So you write each statement is a separate end unit test. So your tests end up being very light, the tests you end up writing. You write more, but they're very 2-3 lines at the most.
Okay.
The other beauty is they're reusable. So if you have, for instance, in the tic-tac-toe game, we have a lot of statements in Gherkin, and that's the kind of the exercise to do is the tic-tac-toe game. We have a lot of Gherkin statements get reused, like when I put X in the middle square. I may have that in 6 different scenarios.
Okay.
The beauty of Gherkin is it recognizes that, as long as I type it the same way, the same statement, mm-hmm. it recognizes, okay, this is the same step, so I'm not going to make you write 6 different unit tests. I'm going to find the one unit test that maps to this line of Gherkin, and I'm going to reuse it over and over again.
Okay.
So you reach a point where you're still writing Gherkin, but the amount of tests you have to create starts to go down dramatically because you already have this kind of rich library of tests.
Okay.
And we've gotten to points where BAs have written Gherkin,
uh-huh.
and... We just stop having to write tests because the Gherkin, they're writing the same lines over and over again, just in different orders, different configurations, mm-hmm. and the tests are already there. So they can keep creating these and keep running them, and it doesn't really create any additional work for the developers.
So make sure I understand the tools that you're talking about here.
Right.
Visual Studio, the developers, of course, knew that, and right now there appears to be a dependency between Gherkin and Visual Studio.
Well, with SpecFlow, because it expects the Gherkin to be in Visual Studio. Yeah.
Okay. So SpecFlow expects it, and so Gherkin and SpecFlow are both products that will run inside of Visual Studio.
Right. So, well, okay. Gherkin is actually more of a language, and that's kind of and the great thing about Gherkin is it's that DSL we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
It's portable. So I'm writing my Gherkin tests, and right now I'm using them in SpecFlow to test my .NET. If for whatever reason we decide we need to do this product in Ruby as well.
Mm-hmm.
I can take those same Gherkin tests, and the equivalent on the Ruby side is a tool called Cucumber.
That's the equivalent of SpecFlow.
Of SpecFlow, yeah. Okay. And actually, Cucumber was first, so
yep.
It's kind of the grand.
That's why Gherkin.
Hence Gherkin. See what they did there? But I could take those tests, and I could, the same exact test, it's totally portable, move it to Cucumber, and I have all my tests now for a Ruby project.
Okay.
I need to do the same thing.
Okay.
Or there are tools to do it with JavaScript and a variety of other things as well.
Hmm.
So those tests become completely portable.
Okay.
Well, the Gherkin becomes completely portable.
Where are these? Are these open source projects, commercial projects? What
SpecFlow? Well, Cucumber is, I believe, open source. Uh-huh. I haven't really, to be honest, I haven't delved that deep into it. I'm not a Ruby developer.
What about Gherkin?
Gherkin is, I believe, it's a standardized DSL.
There's
a standard out there. You don't have to pay for it. It's kind of like JavaScript in that it's a language. There's a standard. There's hopefully people who are maintaining the standard, but it's kind of a free
I think I misunderstood. So Gherkin is just the language, And SpecFlow implements that.
SpecFlow implements
there's nothing that, other than SpecFlow, there's nothing I need to install to get Gherkin to work.
No.
Okay. No. Once I install SpecFlow, SpecFlow understands, among other things, understands the language of Gherkin.
Yes.
Okay. I'm sorry. I didn't get that. SpecFlow, is that a commercial product?
That is. It's created by a company called TechTalk. They do not charge for it. I'm not exactly. I don't know if it's. I don't think it's open source. I'm not 100% sure, to be honest. But they have a really good website, and it's free to download. There is an installer you have to put on each machine you're going to use it on. Additionally, when you create a project for your tests, there is a NuGet package you'll need to get based on what testing framework, and that will install the assemblies in your project that you need to run it. And then you're good. That's everything you need, and that's all free, and you can go out and get it today. There are some Gherkin editing tools that will allow you to edit those Gherkin files outside of Visual Studio. Some of those are paid, some of those aren't. We've been experimenting with some. We haven't found one that really knocks our socks off yet.
Okay.
But we're still looking.
Okay. What's been the acceptance and the attitude of these BAs that are using these tools and writing this new language that they didn't know before?
Sure.
Are they adopting it? Are they embracing it? Or
For the most part, they are. You know, I think they were a little skeptical at first. I think, you know, it's a little intimidating. You tell them they're going to be writing Gherkin in this DSL.
Mm-hmm.
Once they start getting into it and they start seeing how easy it is, they become very comfortable with it.
Good.
The developers, at first, they were a little skeptical of BAs writing tests, to be honest. But once they kind of saw the value in it, they came around as well.
And they're still writing other tests as well.
They're still writing other tests as well. Yeah, I still am a big believer in the unit testing. Because the thing, when you talk about the distinction between unit tests and integration tests, unit tests are great because I want to focus on one small thing. Mm-hmm. I want to make sure that's right. Especially when you get into larger systems. Integration tests will help you with that too, but the problem is they take so long to run. And if I have a problem, I'm not looking at one thing. I'm looking at eight different things.
So I don't know exactly what code I need to fix.
Right. I have a lot more triage I have to do. Additionally, if you're using a dynamic language, like, say, Ruby or JavaScript, I don't see a way you can be productive without unit tests because you don't have a compiler to back you up. So to me, that's like skydiving without a parachute. Okay. And it's something you shouldn't do. So we want our guys to kind of be a little bit cross or polyglot, kind of cross platform. So we try to really drill in that TDD mindset and that TDD culture.
Okay.
And there's still value in that. And again, I mean, a lot of this is kind of where you get into the opinions. A lot of people who are into BDD and ATDD will say, you don't need unit tests now, you have this. And they add value, but at the same time, I have on my current project I'm working on actually today, I think 250 unit tests are in about 10 seconds, and we have 150 integration tests are in about 15 minutes.
That's pretty good.
It's pretty good. But if you tell a developer they have to sit and wait 15 minutes for these tests to pass.
Well, it wouldn't be good for continuous integration.
Well, for continuous integration, it'd be fine, but before check-in just to make sure they haven't broken anything.
Yeah.
You know, I run those unit tests constantly.
Okay.
But I can't run the integration tests that take 15 minutes at a time.
Right.
So that's definitely a factor.
So you cover this in your book.
This is actually not in the book. This has actually come out since the book.
Okay.
I would love to do a second version or second edition of the book, in which case I'll probably delve more into this. Although in my book, I use a framework called NBehave, and that has some syntax as far as your asserts that are very similar to BDD. It's not quite a BDD framework. Like, it doesn't support Gherkin, but what it does is, normally with NUnit, you'll have your test, and you'll do some stuff, and at the end you'll have assert. What NBehave does is it's basically a framework that works with NUnit. And it kind of changes the way you write your test. Instead of having one test method where you do your setup and your teardown and your checks, you have three kind of main methods you work with. You have a because of event, literally called because_of, where you do all your setup.
Okay.
That's called established context. You have established context where you do all your setup. Then you have a method called because of where you actually execute your test and you get your result. And then you have I believe the method is called then, but I have to go back and check. But you have a method called then where you actually do your evaluation, which kind of seems a little weird at first if you've been running in unit tests. Why do I have these three methods? Well, for one thing, it's not quite as close to bridging the gap as Gherkin is, but it does help when you're showing a BA or a user. It does help them a little bit see kind of the logical
read
steps.
That
yeah.
And it sounds like English more or less.
Yeah. And actually, the other thing is that I've been able to find some ways to exploit that where, and I'm sure you've been into this with TDD too, you have four tests and they all have the same setup over and over again. Sometimes you can extract that out to a method. Sometimes it's really difficult because you end up having like a dozen output parameters, which are a little squirrely. But because everything's split into a method that gets called by the framework, I can have one established context method and just inherit from that class and just call that over and over again. So I write that once, but I can use it across multiple tests.
Right.
Now, having said that, nbehave, I don't know how well supported it is anymore. I think Speckflow has kind of stolen their thunder. And kind of I've come to the opinion lately, if you're going to do BDD, if you're going to do TDD, don't do it halfway, just do it. Just jump in and do it. And the best way to do that is with Speckflow right now.
Where's a good place for people to get started if they want to learn more?
The Speckflow website, and I believe it's techtalk.com. If that's not right, you can Google it and it'll be the first thing that comes up. There's a good video on there that'll explain it. Basically, it's a 12-minute video. It shows you how to go through your first writing a feature, then writing the Gherkin, then writing the tests. They've got some other links to blogs off that site, too, people who are doing it. I don't know of any books right now that talk about it. There are some good kind of higher-level BDD books out there. I would go on Amazon and try and find one of those. But really, it's kind of a little bit of a... the good thing is Speckflow is very easy to learn and get to use. And if you know Gherkin, it even becomes easier. But there's not a whole lot of documentation out there about how to get it set up, best practices. It's kind of still a little bit in its infancy, but it's very promising. Especially the last couple of versions, they've really increased some of the quality of features and stability of the product. So,
are you blogging about it?
I am in the process of moving my blog at the moment, but as soon as it's back up, I will be blogging about that and various other things.
So your blog is not available, you only promote it?
Well, it's at jamescbender.com, and I think if you go there today, you're going to get the old ugly subtext blog. I'm actually waiting
so
for my...
The content is there, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe you care about how pretty it is, but I think most people don't.
The content's there. I'm moving it to Azure, Azure. I'm just waiting for my provider now to change my CNAME record, but unfortunately you have to do a help ticket, and that takes hours and whatever. So we'll see. I'm not knock on wood, it'll be done by the time this gets to air, but...
James, thanks a lot.
Thanks, sir.
Good stuff.
Good stuff. Hey, everybody. Technology and Friends. It's like my 10th favorite podcast of all time. So check it out.